Me in your Bibles, please, for our first reading to Psalm 78. Psalm 78, verse 1, hear now the inerrant, infallible, and inspired word of God, Maskil of Asaph. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and forget not the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. The children of Ephraim, being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. They kept not the covenant of God and refused to walk in his law and forgot his works and his wonders that he had showed them. Marvelous things did he in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through. He made the waters to stand as an heap. In the daytime also he led them with a cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He clave the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink as out of the great depths. He brought streams also out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. And they sinned yet more against him by provoking the Most High in the wilderness. And they tempted God in their heart by asking meat for their lust. Yea, they spake against God. They said, can God furnish a table in the wilderness? Behold, he smote the rock that the waters gushed out and streams overflowed. Can he give bread also? Can he provide flesh for his people? Therefore the Lord heard this and was wroth. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel, because they believed not God and trusted not in his salvation. Though he had commanded the clouds from above and opened the doors of heaven and had rained down manna upon them to eat and had given them of the corn of heaven, man did eat angels' food. He sent them meat to the full. He caused an east wind to blow in the heaven, and by his power he brought in the south wind. He rained flesh also upon them as dust, and feathered fowls like as the sand of the sea. And he let it fall in the midst of their camp, round about their habitation. So they did eat and were well filled, for he gave them their own desire. But they were not estranged from their lust. But while their meat was yet in their mouths, the wrath of God came upon them and slew the fattest of them and smote down the chosen men of Israel. For all this they sinned still and believed not for his wondrous works. Therefore their days did he consume in vanity and their years in trouble. When he slew them, then they sought him, and they returned and inquired early after God. And they remembered that God was their rock and the high God their redeemer. Nevertheless they did flatter him with their mouths, and they lied unto him with their tongues. For their heart was not right with him, neither were they steadfast in his covenant. But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and destroyed them not. Yea, many a time turned he his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath. For he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passeth away and cometh not again. How oft did they provoke him in the wilderness and grieve him in the desert? Yea, they turned back and tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. They remembered not his hand, nor the day when he delivered them from the enemy, how he had wrought his signs in Egypt and his wonders in the field of Zoan, and had turned their rivers into blood and their floods that they could not drink. He sent diverse sorts of flies among them which devoured them, and frogs which destroyed them. He gave also their increase to the caterpillar and their labor unto the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore trees with frost. He gave up their cattle also to the hail and their flocks to hot thunderbolts. He cast upon them the fierceness of his anger, wrath and indignation and trouble by sending evil angels among them. He made a way to his anger. He spared not their soul from death, but gave their life over to the pestilence, and smote all the firstborn in Egypt, the chief of their strength in the tabernacles of Ham, but made his own people to go forth like sheep, and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. And he led them on safely, so that they feared not, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And he brought them to the border of his sanctuary, even to this mountain, which his right hand had purchased. He cast out the heathen also before them and divided them an inheritance by line and made the tribes of Israel to dwell in their tents. Yet they tempted and provoked the Most High God and kept not his testimonies, but turned back and dealt unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places, and moved him to jealousy with their graven images. When God heard this, he was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel. So he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he placed among men, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. He gave his people over also unto the sword, and was wroth with his inheritance. The fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given to marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation. Then the Lord awaked as one out of sleep, and like a mighty man that shouteth by hearts, he put them to a perpetual reproach. Moreover, he refused the tabernacle of Joseph, and chose not the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah, the Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like high palaces, like the earth which he hath established forever. He chose David also, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes, great with young, he brought him to feed Jacob his people, and Israel his inheritance. So he fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. May God add his blessing to the reading and hearing of his most holy word. Well, I must apologize for my behavior last service. It was pointed out to me that while I said it in the introduction in Psalm 77 that it was a psalm written by Asaph, several times I referred to the Davidic authorship of Psalm 77, which I do not think is true, so please forgive me for misspeaking. We have the same in Psalm 78. We have a maskil of Asaph. And if we take a look at the history that is described in Psalm 78, it seems to go, although it may go a little beyond that, but it seems to go to the Davidic monarchy, perhaps even into the Solomonic monarchy, as we talk about the tabernacle being built as a palace, perhaps even all the way to Solomon. But that seems to be the history of it. And so what do we have then? We have probably the true Asaph, the one that lived in David's day, as the one who penned this psalm, of the prior history and then the current history of redemption that he himself knew and understood. Okay, so that's what we have then by way of authorship. The psalm is obviously quite long, as we have just seen, but it is divided into several sections. And the first thing that I want us all to see, that I hope we will all see here, is that this first section describes for us with great specificity and direction, that it is the job of the parents of every generation to teach their children the great things of God. Now, that doesn't preclude grandparents from entering into those labors, or uncles or aunts or even older brothers and sisters. No, we understand all of that to be true. But, my dear brothers and sisters, we live in an age where the society around us teaches us that whatever it is that parents ought to do for their children, that it can be relegated to others, that it can be given to someone else. Now, we've all seen perhaps those old movies where we have, some aristocracy in the West that is raising children, and the raising of those children is given over to governesses, perhaps, or to servants, perhaps, and so on. But there is something that we have all learned that I hope we will remember in this connection, and that is that while we can delegate authority, we can never delegate responsibility. That we will always be responsible as parents for the education of our children. The buck stops there. And it always will. This is how God has set it up. And so when we see then all of these other structures that have been erected around us in the church and in the state that take over for parents in this thing or that thing, in the raising of children, even now, you know, I'm grieved to say it. I'm grieved that the situation exists, and I'm grieved that we have come this far. But we have school lunch programs, really, that while they do some good in that, they probably give to children the only good meal that they would ever have that day. And I say that with grief. Still, there is a usurpation of parental authority, and parents are trying as best they can to give up their responsibilities in such ways. And that is not a recipe for anything positive in the long run. It is grievous to think about, but that's the truth. Often we hear in the church and in the state with regard to someone's responsibility, they're not doing it, so I have to do it for them. And very often that ends up then as a usurpation of proper authority. And whenever some entity usurps that which God has designed, listen, God has designed it for a purpose. God designed that parents should train their children, and you've heard me say this before, I'll say it again. The state makes a poor parent. The church makes a poor parent. Parents make really good parents if they prosecute that parenthood according to the commands of God. And may I say it this way, and I probably realize I'm in the minority, but it chokes me up to say it, that if we are in the minority in believing that and pressing that, we look around us and we only see the sad effects of those usurpations. It's not getting better, brothers and sisters, unless the Lord sends a fresh wave of understanding, not only to the church, but then to the church as she rises up and teaches the culture. We won't have it. We'll just keep going down and down and down. So the rising up of, you know, they're not doing it, so somebody's got to do it, that often ends up in, in one of two things, right? So it ends up perhaps in a destruction entirely of the entity that God established for our good as our kind creator, right? So now there are voices in our society calling for the destruction of the family as an ineffective institution. When a family, or the family as a concept, becomes perverted in its activity, when a government becomes perverted in its activity, when a church becomes perverted in its activity, these things that God has established, listen, we must not abolish them, we must reform them. That's the goal. To say something's not working, so we must do away with it, when God in His kind and creatorly care has given it to us as a race, and He's given us those three spheres, the family, church, and state, He gives them to us, and we say we must abolish them at our own peril. And the abolition of them will indeed never, in the long run, make for anything positive, but for many things negative, deleterious, and destructive to our current state. So, Psalm 78, at the beginning of that psalm, makes that very, very clear, that it is the great things of God that are to be pressed from one generation to another. And then beyond that, generation upon generation. It is the great things of God, the testimony of Jacob, the law in Israel. These are the things. And note the specificity that the psalmist descends to in making those things known. It's not just make sure your kids are Christians. It's teach them the testimony, teach them the law, teach them the gospel, teach them all of those things. The church cannot do it for you, mom and dad. The state cannot do it for you, mom and dad. That is the responsibility of Christian parents. And it pleases me to see that you are taking up that with great seriousness. When I see some of the effort that goes into homeschooling and catechizing and so on, it is extremely encouraging to your pastor to see that. So keep up the good work. All right, so then in the second section, and I'm going to divide that up where we come to Ephraim in verse 9. Notice that they didn't get it. That in Ephraim, they didn't get that. They were armed and they carried bows, but they turned back in the day of battle. They kept not the covenant of God and refused to walk in His law and forgot His works and His wonders that He had showed them. And although it is not explicit in the passage, I'm going to say it's implicit in the passage that there was a failure of parents to children. Now, we can't blame every wayward child. We can't blame the parents in that. We don't want to be, you know, automaticos in that way, that we're just turning a crank. And, you know, this is the error of many in the homeschool movement, at least of a few years back, where they'd say the way to raise godly kids is you just homeschool them and clickety, 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 click. You turn that crank and out spits this ticket that says godly child on it. No, it doesn't happen that way. You know, those of us who have been in those trenches understand that. That's not how it happens. And yet, in this passage, we can speak in these broad strokes, the children of Ephraim didn't get it. They broke the covenant that they had with God. They forgot His wonders and His works, perhaps because they were not being proclaimed to them as they should have been, which is what the prior section says. All right, and children, the land of Ham is simply the land of Egypt. Ham was that descendant of Noah that ended up going down into that part of the world where the Egyptians grew up, but more than just the Egyptians, right? The Ethiopians, the Ludim, further to the west, Libya, you know, that North African set of people, they are the descendants of Ham most properly. And anybody remember what Ham's son was named? Canaan. And why is it then that we have Canaanites away from the land of their ancestry when we come to the children of Israel? It's a very interesting question, isn't it? Something to think about. Okay. So then we recount the great things that God did for them while they were in the wilderness, when He caused them to pass through the waters, and then also when they were in the wilderness, He clave the rock and waters flowed for them. He fed them out of almost nothing, right? With the manna, it appeared for them every morning. But what did they do? They sinned more and more against Him, and they provoked the Most High in the wilderness. They tempted God in their heart by asking for flesh in their, what does it say, in their lust. In other words, they didn't control their wanters. Covetousness, which is idolatry, according to the Apostle Paul, got the better of them in the wilderness, and they began asking God for things that He had not provided for them. And they even said things that are implied here about the flesh pots in Egypt and about the leeks and the onions and all of the other things that they wanted, rather than what God had already done for them and was giving them. And so they provoked the Most High to anger with their complaints, with their discontent. And so the Lord gave them their desire. He gave them quails. In fact, they had quails coming out of their ears, you might say. I think the way Moses puts it, quoting what God told him, I'll give them quails until it comes out of their nostrils. I think that's how God said it. Okay? But notice that while the meat was in their mouth, even while they were enjoying that flesh, God's anger was kindled against them. So we learn a very important lesson there, right? Be careful what you ask God for. Sometimes He'll give it to you, and it was the worst thing that you could have asked for. And He will do that in His fatherly chastisements. So we must be careful not to murmur against Him, and then also not to ask for things that we ought not to be asking for. He gave them their heart's lust, and they fell under the judgment of God. The wrath of God came upon them in verse 31, and slew the fattest of them, and smote down the chosen men of Israel. We have to understand what that means by the fattest of them. We think, you know, those were the sloppy ones. No, the fattest ones in this kind of parlance would have been the most healthy ones of them, right? Keep in mind, it was a people that was on a 40-year campout trip. They couldn't go to the grocery store or to the restaurant and eat to the full. They ate manna little by little every day, which was sustenance food, and they were indeed very sad to have only that. But for a church under age, what a better food to have. The Lord fed them in a sustenance way so that their hearts might be toward Him. But they didn't draw back their hearts from their lusts. Okay, so now we go on, and we find that covenant that we read about earlier in verse 10, now notice it becomes, it comes to the fore again. Nevertheless, they did flatter Him with their mouth. I'm in verse 36. And they lied unto Him with their tongues. Their heart was not right with Him, neither were they steadfast in His covenant. So that covenant comes to mind again. And let's just go ahead and make a poke at those who say that was a covenant of works, because the next verse puts the lie to that. What does it say? It says, but He, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and destroyed them not, yea, many a time turned He His anger away and did not stir up all His wrath, for He remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passeth away and cometh not again. And so this speaks to that covenant as a covenant of works, sorry, of grace, because there was forgiveness and mercy in it. And God received them even though they were sinning against Him, which is always the earmark of a covenant of grace and never of a covenant of works. All right, so then we move on. The psalmist goes on to talk about what the Lord had done for them in Egypt. Again, some of those great works that they had forgotten. And so we hear about the division of the sea and them walking through on dry land. We hear about the curses that took place in the land of Egypt. And then finally that culminates in verse 51 with the smiting of the firstborn in Egypt, the chief of their strength in the tabernacles of Ham. Then we talk about the Exodus. He made His own people to go forth and guided them in the wilderness like a flock, and all of the other great things that God did. And this goes down to verse 55. He cast out the heathen before them and divided them an inheritance by line and made the tribes of Israel to dwell in their tents. Verse 56. Yet they tempted Him again, even after settling the land of promise. And so this is a record then of the people of God up to David's day, and it is a record of God's faithfulness and their unfaithfulness over and again. And yet when they called upon the Lord in their straits and in their difficulties, what did He say? If I can put it in the parlance of this morning's sermon, He said, "You're mine, I will care for you. You're mine, I will receive you. You are my people." We go down now to the Lord forsaking the tabernacle of Shiloh. We remember that, right? That's when they had taken the Ark of the Covenant of God out to fight the Philistines like a lucky charm, and it was stolen from them, and they put it in the temple of Dagon. You remember all of that? Okay, so now this puts an understanding on what it means that He smote His enemies in the hinder parts. That doesn't mean He smote the back of the back of their troops. It means he smote them in their hinder parts. You remember what happened in those days and how they had to make little statues of their what the King James calls their emerods, right? And they had to make statues out of those and send them back on a cart with two brand new with two milk kine that had just given birth to calves, and away they go, right, with the offering and with those little statues. Then finally, notice verse 67, the establishment of David in his kingdom. He refused the tabernacle of Joseph and chose not the tribe of Ephraim. He chose the tribe of Judah, the Mount Zion, which he loved, and he built his sanctuary like high palaces, like the earth which he hath established forever. And he chose David also his servant. That brings us up to Asaph's day. And so what do we learn from Asaph? We learn that we can look back at the great works of God and take courage from them, take encouragement to obedience from them, and that we can look back at the times in our own ancestry, the history of the people of God, the history perhaps of our own families as we go back, our own history as we go back to our youth. And we can do what? We can see that we have failed as well, but full of pity, he forgave. Full of pity, he drew us near. Full of pity, then, he did not cast us off. And that's really what Psalm 78 is about. And that's what we should teach our children. Thus ends the reading, then, of Psalm 78.